Welcome to the Casturbis podcast. My name is Christian Corley. His name is James McLean. And just so you all know what's going on, it is the 400th anniversary of some bloke committing a terror act this evening, and lots of people are celebrating it by making loud bangs. So if you hear anything, that's what it is. Do not be alarmed. It's simply fireworks. There's another one. James, how are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
Glad to hear it. We are here, as you guessed by the theme tune, to talk Doctor Who. It is November 2023, so it's clearly a very significant year in Doctor Who. It is the 60th anniversary of this ridiculously long-running, incredibly silly, at times frustrating, at times angering, and at other times simply wondrous and enchanting television programme / comic book series / novelisation series / original novel series / audio. Did I do audio? I don't know. And also, I guess, for a short time, movie series. It's also a bit of a silly old thing, really, Doctor Who, isn't it?
Also slash. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
There's
yes.
a lot of it out there.
There is, yes, yeah. In both senses of the in all senses of the word. It is a crazy old thing, isn't it, Doctor Who? Really?
Yes, it is. It's a crazy old thing.
This isn't where we intended this podcast to go, but it has occurred to me that Doctor Who, I mean, just looking at what's around at the moment, and we're going to come to that because we're basically here to just point you in the direction of the various new and old and new old Doctor Who that's popping up throughout November. But it is a balmy old load of hoo-ha is Doctor Who. And I'm minded at how crackers Doctor Who fans are by another momentous or culturally significant event. That, in fact, two, actually, that have taken place recently. Possibly three, all in the music side. You've got the Rolling Stones' new album and their surprisingly energetic single, Angry. You've got the Beatles with their somnambulistic, almost Cabinet of Dr. Caligari level of reanimation taking place there with Now and Then. I'm sorry if you're a fan of that, but I'm not. And you've also got this, I didn't know about this until a couple of days ago, the immense Prince Diamonds and Pearls re-release with something like 7,023 new recordings on it. And all these things have their own fandoms and their own enthusiasts, and they're all as mixed and positive and negative and angsty and want to move on, or I'm just getting into this and I need to know everything about it and I've forgotten about this for so long and now it's back again and it's awesome and I want to catch up as Doctor Who. And I think James's other podcast series that we're running at the moment with John Kenneth Moore about Star Trek, obviously that's another long-running thing, and it's another long-running thing. And if you listen to the first part, we've got the second part coming along in a few days, you'll get a good flavour of the fact that there's all these different Star Treks, and all these different Star Treks have their own individual fandoms, don't they?
Yeah.
Which is, if you're not a Star Trek person, or a quote-unquote Trekkie, I'm not entirely sure how legitimate that phrase is these days, but we'll come on to the use and adoption and all the related aspects to do with fandom names in a moment, I suspect. If you didn't know that, and I certainly didn't, then the fact that there's so many different Doctor Who media and that they all have their own different fandoms, and then you've got the different eras of Doctor Who, which essentially is more or less, I suppose, on a par with all the fact that there's different Star Treks, I just don't know what to make of it all anymore. It's like there's new worlds opening up that I wasn't previously aware of. And I think a lot of these new things that are coming along in November 2023, because that is where we are now insanely, is as good a time as any to shine a light on them, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it reminds me of the sort of, if you go and look at Japan's media, there's been for a long time a very different approach to media than we have in the West in terms of what one author, Mark Steinberg, calls the media mix. And it's this notion that there's far less kind of like hierarchy, I hope I get this right, hierarchy to Japan's media, so far as that there's no obvious inlet into a franchise. So for over here, up until the last, maybe until the last 10 years, Doctor Who, to some degree, with Dan, no, even Doctor Who, you kind of knew what tier was the most relevant or the most dominant selection of that franchise, and that would tend to be the entry point. And that would be considered, like, so for instance, for film, would tend to be considered, say with Star Trek, you know, they would say the television films are the dominant, that's the entry point. Then you've got the books and the comics, but they're kind of for the sort of more fanish people, perhaps, and carry perhaps a less energy or agency in the direction of your franchise.
Right.
While in Japan, there's been a kind of sort of far more sort of flattened, sort of kind of what we've got now with Marvel, and to some degree what may be sort of slowly happening with Doctor Who, where the, you know, where a franchise is across so many different forms of consumption. And I say consumption because quite literally, and I know we've had them in the West as well, but characters from certain franchises will appear on a lot of sort of confectionery and food as well, and that be kind of considered as well as a sort of entry point. So over there, it was for a while, it's kind of had this sort of spread out multiple ways in. I mean, you also think of like manga to anime to film versions, and everything is a little more leveled out than it has been over in the West, until kind of, as I say, like with Marvel, where suddenly, you know, whether the television or the comics or the films, you know, it's hard. The entry points are multiple, and none of them are necessarily the dominant part of the franchise. And I think that's kind of what has been argued Japan has had for a while.
Right.
We've been able to see snippets of it, I think, in the West with some of the video games that come over, the imported over, where they'll have multiple versions of their multiple franchise characters fighting together in various sort of battle modes. But that's kind of where they've been, and that's kind of where the West is going, I think. And obviously Marvel's done this for the last, you know, well, since they've been building on it since, what, about 2010, in terms of a real solid direction. But kind of like going to Doctor Who at the moment with the very strong branding this last month with the Hooniverse, which has been a phrase which has been around for a while.
Yeah.
To be actually now kind of branded part of it. This sort of, and with you know, already having sort of Big Finish comics, books and all the like, but there's still quite a hierarchy to it. I wonder if then that's going to slowly flatten, a bit like we've seen with Disney doing with Marvel and Marvel and Star Wars. Just a thought.
I guess, I mean, the whole Hooniverse thing, I'm a little bit, I mean, it's wonderful that it has happened, but I'm not keen on the name. I've got to be honest.
You get used to it.
Well, I'm not sure I will. Do you know, actually, I wasn't on iPlayer the other night, but I was on ITVX. I think we possibly discussed my movement from BritBox to ITVX some months ago. I'm pretty sure there was a mention of it, and the fact that I had both accounts running concurrently for absolutely no reason other than the fact that Fawlty Towers and something else that I liked hadn't been moved over to ITVX and wasn't even available as like a BritBox on ITVX thing like Doctor Who is. Eventually, I've given up with BritBox. They're clearly not going to put Fawlty Towers on anytime soon on ITVX, but, you know, I've got them on DVD. And I've got them on Blu-ray. And I've got them on vinyl.
Why is it such a big deal then? If A, you already have them on potentially two.
It just felt like a thing that had to be there that I could then just put up without having to, you know, the convenience factor of not having to put a disc in.
But do you watch? Would you?
I would watch Fawlty Towers, yeah.
I mean, if you've listened to the podcast, which I know you have, with me and Muir, this whole point of like there being so much stuff, where do you get the time to find moments where you'd watch Fawlty Towers? Do you genuinely find the time to sort of rewatch stuff that you've enjoyed and that you sort of have as close to your heart?
Me personally, speaking to you, Christian Corley, I do have the time. It's very scant. For instance, bedtime is a good time. Kerry likes to watch telly at bedtime, literally in bed with the telly on. This was a new thing to me until around the mid to late, well, the late 90s, at bedtime to me was everything goes off, you close your eyes and go to sleep and hope that the potash train running past your house every 40 minutes didn't wake you up. When I first moved in with a lady, she was another person that had the telly on at night time. It kind of went from there. Kerry, she loves having the telly on at night time. Many nights, we rewatch old episodes of Midsummer Murders because we find that they're just the right level to encourage a wander into the arms of Morpheus.
But that's what's interesting, because, I mean, by my calculations, per week, you have seven bedtimes.
Yes.
Well, I was just doing the arithmetic. Give me a chance. Got seven bedtimes in that
week.
If
you're lucky.
If you're lucky. I mean, I suppose, theoretically, you could have more bedtimes if you wish to have them, or less if you wish to have them. But as a standard, you have seven bedtimes.
Yes, that's the vanilla bedtimes.
So that's seven episodes of something a week.
Yeah.
Now, even something like Midsummer Murders is going to keep you going for a while. And there's a lot of other things from our past.
Yes, there is, yes.
I'm glad you brought that up. It's still not a massive amount of time to be worrying about Fawlty Towers.
No, it's not. But I have been able to watch episodes of The Sweeney. No, I've never seen The Sweeney. It was on too late for me as a small child. And although I imagine The Professionals was probably on around the same time, and I recall seeing plenty of those, having revisited Professionals 15 years ago or so.
However, the Professionals tended to have quite an early evening slot in the 80s as repeats.
There was that as well. Yeah, the repeats, yeah. With The Sweeney, though, I came across an episode in the first series of The Sweeney the other evening that Kerry selected, which had an awesome guest cast of Christopher Ellison, Tony Caunter, he was Roy Evans in EastEnders for the more recently television-minded, and Tony Selby.
Yeah, I know that.
Zablon Glitz, yeah. It was a good episode. I enjoyed it immensely. And I like seeing... I mean, we're probably going to get off the point here if we're not careful, but I do enjoy watching the old episodes of The Sweeney and Professionals. Another shows from that time, The Return of the Saint, that's another one. Which, funnily enough, my Return of the Saint box set was given to me by Anthony
I'm sorry,
Dry.
I mean... I feel
Which
like
was my attempt at a segue, but go on.
I feel like we're rushing down the rapids, and you've said to me that we're actually holding onto a rock, which I've obviously been clearly unaware of. There was a point. Just remind me of the point, because the listener might need reminding of the point here. And I think you might need reminding of the point, because you've gone... Exactly. So we are just rushing down the rapids towards the waterfall at the end. But no worries. In 90% of film and television, waterfalls are not a problem.
Okay. Are you going to remind me the point, or are you unaware of it as well?
I was being genuine. I don't know what the point was. That was what I was asking.
Okay.
And neither do you.
So if we can reposition ourselves on this podcast. Doctor Who, the Hooniverse, iPlayer. There's Doctor Who goddamn everywhere at the moment. We've been using the Twitter accounts to highlight a few things. And Philip Bates, who's going to be on the podcast in a couple of weeks' time, I hope, at least once, of the Doctor Who Companion, has obviously been posting a lot of stuff as well. I think possibly it's a good idea to highlight three main things at this point, and then we'll consider a few others. First of all, there's the Doctor Who 60th anniversary television episodes. They have their own Target novelizations. There's The Star Beast by Gary Russell. There is Wild Blue Yonder by Mark Morris, and The Giggle by James Moss, all of which are adorned by artwork, either in whole or collaboratively, by Anthony Dry. We also have the Warp Warp 6 as well, which I didn't know about until very, very recently. That's coming along in a few weeks' time as well. I believe it's something like 160, 180 pages, celebrating the 60th anniversary of An Unearthly Child. And there is the other thing, which is called Children of the Circus, this isn't like a big thing, this is a much smaller thing, but I think a lot of people should be aware of Children of the Circus, an audio play based on The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, the seventh Doctor Who serial. Links to all of those things, and that's based on an idea by Barnaby Eaton-John, who a long time ago contributed reviews and whimsically amusing articles for the Old Castobus website, which is why I thought it was worth mentioning.
the last one, is that a Big Finish? What's that done
It is
for?
Not. No, it's not. It's, BBC, from it, AUK Studios.
Okay.
They've done a few other things. Toy Wilcox is in it as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's worth keeping an eye on as well for when that arrives. Sophie Aldred's, as is Sylvester McCoy, although I'm not entirely sure what they're doing. They're here, but not as you'd expect, says Toya Wilcox. And I'm not going into it any further than that. I will link to it in the show notes. But I guess there's this whole thing. I mean, it's obviously, of course, people are going to collaboratively release and sort of coagulate and collaborate. And there's another word I'm looking for, I'll begin with CO, around Doctor Who's 60th anniversary with their various projects. So it should come as no surprise that these things are happening.
Right, you still haven't really got to the point again. Do you need to do that sound effect and go back to the beginning?
I don't know. What is the, I mean, the point of this podcast is to point people in the direction of Doctor Who 60th anniversary things, isn't it? Which I think I've just succeeded in, if I may say so, an admirably efficient method.
Yeah, but you've missed out things like, surely like the bookend stories, the omnibus stories on iPlayer, the Daleks colour that's coming up.
Yes, but if you would let me, I wanted to get to the Daleks in another way.
Okay, that's good. I've broken another segue. Excellent.
So, last night I stuck on, as I was saying before, we got very distracted with, this is the point I was coming to. Yes, thank you. BritBox through ITV Player, ITVX. Beg your pardon. You get the whole Doctor Who collection on BritBox, and I selected,
but not Fawlty Towers.
Not Fawlty Towers, no.
Okay, just checking.
And I opted for Day of the Daleks because it's long. It's probably my favourite. It's definitely my favourite Pertwee era Dalek series, if not my favourite seventies era Dalek serial. And I was very pleased. I suspected it might be, but there's no sort of toggle like there is on the DVD to make it the special edition version, but it was the special edition version. So that made me very, very pleased and warm inside. And the reason I selected that particular story, but the fact that it was Daleks at all, was because of something that James has just mentioned.
What's that?
The special edition of the Dalek serial. Which is going to be colourised and
reduced
to a 75-minute quote-unquote blockbuster.
Yes.
Now, I don't wish to upset anyone. I don't wish to denigrate the hard work that's gone into this. I'm sure Mark Eyre's brand new score is very good. And this is something that will be part of quote-unquote the Hooniverse online. And it's going to be arriving on BBC4 on Doctor Who's 60th anniversary. But we already have a roughly 75-minute blockbuster full-colour version of the Daleks.
Otherwise known as
Doctor Who and the Daleks.
Oh, I was going to say the clown meets the Pepper Potts, because I think there is a distinction between where you're going. I know where you're going with this, and I can see your point, but I would say there's a big distinction here. But do carry on. Fawlty Towers, you're saying. Move on.
There's a movie. I just don't see any point in replicating a replication.
I don't think the point of it is to replicate a replication.
What is the point of it?
I think the point of it is to take one of the sort of landmark stories of the television shows and colourise that historical production. And I think that's, to me, it's kind of exciting. Because to me, there is a massive difference between a 70-minute William Russell-led, essentially, Doctor Who and the Dead Planet, etc., and the 75, 80, whatever it is, minute Roy Castle and Creepy Cushing. So, because let's face it, just occurred to me right now at this moment, he is kind of creepy in that, but in a different way to some how he is in other shows. But there is something kind of,
I was watching those. I was watching those outtakes from the original Star Wars movie between Cushing and Carrie Fisher. And the moment when he breaks character, there's just a very brief moment where he returns to being Peter Cushing.
But I think for me, and again, just something I've thought about, it's not an ongoing thing, but you think of Peter Cushing's The Doctor, or the Doctor Who or Doctor Who or D Who, his character, his cute grandfather character is the sort of character in any other film that by the end of the film, the glasses would come off and there would be a benevolent side to that person, because the way he plays him is so gentle and unreal, and yet somehow an archetype for the nice granddad, that you almost feel that in a film that would have to be revealed at some point to have been a persona of something else with some other motive. But it isn't. That is who he is. And in that sense, I kind of find him a bit creepy, because you almost feel like there's something there which you're just not seeing. And if he was actually like the real Doctor, you could get away with that and go, well, yeah, absolutely. Look at Sylvester McCoy or Tom Baker or any of them, that there is obviously layers of there of who is he? He is a mystery. But in the film, he's not a mystery at all. It's all laid out to you. He is a professor who has created a time machine. That's it. That's who he is.
Yeah.
Yes, he has a rather odd surname. And yes, he doesn't have a first name. But then we only see him for 80 minutes. Maybe there is a story around that we don't know. But the bottom line is that the personality he plays is not a persona. It's not a characterization of an alien pretending or trying to adapt human-like qualities. He is a human with that characteristic, which you'd only assume a human with that characteristic would be hiding something, because it's just too unreal to be real.
Mm.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I can see what you mean, definitely. Yeah.
So if you compare that to the Daleks, you don't have any of that. You don't have any going through your brain. Nor should you really have that going through your brain anyway, because it's way too deep for what that film is. But my point being is I think there are a lot of differences, and I do understand what you mean. I'm not trying to be facetious or pedantic.
I know I'm taking a very small segment of a 7-week serial, 6-week serial.
Okay, well let's spin this round. Let's go into a different universe where they didn't do the Daleks and they weren't foolish enough to have tried to do the Unearthly Child and seen where that led them. What other black and white do you think would have been good to have colorized that would have been significant? And obviously, Dalek Invasion of Earth, you've got the same problem. So,
yeah,
got a backstep from that.
Okay, right. I'm really that glad you prepared me for this.
Well, this is all off the cuff, isn't it?
That's right, dear listener. There's absolutely no preparation to these podcasts whatsoever.
Oh, God, no. No. And if there was, I wouldn't
read
it or listen to it.
We don't have the time for that. I think... I mean, I'm very keen to edge towards the edge of destruction, but of course you can't really. It's too short in the first place. I think maybe perhaps.
And I think it wouldn't interest audiences, because in the end, the Daleks being colorized in its sense, not just for the lust of the fan, but also because the Daleks have a broader significance, which might interest people more if they saw a colorized version of it than a black and white version. Of course, they could watch the Cushing one if they liked. But, like I said, there are now issues there if they've listened to this podcast.
Yes.
So they are now forced to listen to the William Arnold one. But I think that is kind of the point. I think the only thing you could perhaps... it would be really difficult, I think, to actually pick another one that would engage in people to make it worth the cost in actually doing, if you see what I mean.
I know why they've done that and why they've chosen it. The whole doing it, I'm still not 100% certain about, like, the actual rationale of that particular thing. It's a nice idea to do. I think it's good that they're doing it. I just feel like it perhaps doesn't add enough. And then again, on the other hand, was the Daleks already? Was there already a 75 to 90 minute version of the Daleks from the '80s video era?
I was thinking that, and I couldn't think why I was thinking that. And I can't bring out of my brain box. my brain box, my head.
Okay, yeah, of course. What else would it be?
Idiot. I can't think what else.
I think they released it in two or three sets of DVD, VHS.
Well, there was a two-pack VHS.
Right, so they didn't. Yeah, so it wasn't an
episodes one to four and three and five to seven.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm just thinking Peter Cushing's Daleks. I don't know, but I think I think if the strategy, if all had been perfect, I think the strategy here would not have been to dun the Daleks. I think the strategy here in an alternative universe where this was going on, they'd have gone for the Celestial Toymaker. That would have been the one I think they'd have done if right. it existed to do it with.
Yeah.
Because that would have then linked quite nicely with what they're doing now.
So there's no missing episodes missing. In this alternate universe then?
Yeah, that's what I mean. In this alternate universe, right, it's alternate. Right. Okay. Shall we call it Hooniverse?
I wasn't entirely clear on the structure of this universe. Right, okay.
Yeah, well, it's another Hooniverse, but it's a Hooniverse that's not with a W, it's with an H, because it's where we're called Hoonans rather than humans, obviously. This Hooniverse, they actually have all the episodes of Celestial Toymaker, but they don't have all the episodes of Fawlty Towers.
No.
No.
Not even the Christmas special.
Not even the German one. No.
Not even the Christmas special, which doesn't actually exist, but some people think does, which is weird.
Conspiracies.
Mm. Or what's that thing? Mandela Effect.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, though. It's as if you didn't have the Daleks, because, I mean, obviously, like you say, there is almost kind of like a version of the Daleks in colour, which people might have seen. What else do you do? And that becomes quite a difficult one, the one that's got to touch other people. And it's like, well, you can't do Daleks Invasion of Earth. The chase is definitely not worth doing, and it's too long. You'd have to do massive edits to get that to work. Most of the other ones of that sort of era don't really exist in any decent form. So you're getting to the point where you've already backed Day of the Daleks, your favourite. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Even 10th Planet, you know, doesn't exist enough to do it with. So it's very hard to find a landmark story that really would be good to colourise for wider consumption than just fans. So with that in mind, I can see why it is the Daleks.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of excited for it, to be honest. I've not seen it in a while. I've not watched it on this. I mean, the last few days have not been feeling too great. So I've been sitting watching a load of Doctor Who and iPlayer. And it's not one I went to. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing what it will be like. Is it called Tales from the TARDIS? It's something like that, isn't it?
It is, yes. There's Tales from the TARDIS as well. Did you say you'd watched a bit of that?
I've watched... I did watch Earthshock all the way through with the bookends. I watched all the opening bookends to all of them.
Right.
And I started watching the TIE Meddler... I watched all the Three Doctors as well.
Okay.
And the bookends as well.
What do they add?
Well, I mean, it adds a great deal because it explicitly positions yourself to be looking at these events through the lenses of characters who we now see in a new space, having aged, who, in the most of the part, talk about their lives around these events. So, for instance, the Three Doctors one, you get a lot of backstory to what happens after Sarah Jane Adventures. And I think that in itself is kind of interesting. But I think beyond all that, I think, you know, for so many years, I know we've talked about it on the podcast. And I know we specifically talked about, I know I did, with Ian Chesterton, you know, when is Ian coming back? Because, you know, while he's still alive, and it'd be great to sort of reunite some of these people. This does give an opportunity to see those people, those characters as characters within the show once more. You know, Vicky and Stephen. I mean, that who would ever thought we'd see those two as characters come together again? That's great. And I get the impression from what was said earlier, I think in September, October, Dave is kind of intimates that this was almost like an afterthought thing. It wasn't something they came up with initially. And it was just like, why do we do this? And yeah, it feels like that. It's not meant to be like a solid step into the Hooniverse brand, but it was, you know, an easy idea. You know, put these characters in a room, give it a sort of nice little bit of flowery story narrative to it, and bookend stories we've got the access to. And, you know, perhaps even, and by doing so, widen the entry of new fans to old material, which I think is part of the reason they're doing this. I think it's a way to sort of try and re-legitimise the old show with newer fans of the new era, and thus give that reason and that move to iPlayer an even more, you know, a better payoff than, because obviously BritBox, as you say, having already not got Fawlty Towers, or has it? It needs Doctor Who. Well, I mean, quite seriously, Doctor Who was actually quite a big gateway for people to actually get BritBox.
Yeah, yeah.
The entire
yeah,
catalogue no, was yeah, there. Yeah, yeah, so yeah. To lose that and to put that into onto iPlayer.
I mean, in fairness, it should have been bloody on the iPlayer anyway.
Absolutely. But yeah, but we could say that about a lot of stuff from BritBox. I mean, to be quite honest, anything which is, you know, licensed payer money really shouldn't be paywalled on BritBox at all.
No, sure. One Foot in the Grave, that's another one.
But if you're going to have something, yeah, that should be there. I agree with you. And I think if you're trying to flagship or trying to refloat Doctor Who as a flagship, then it's good to have it on iPlayer. And I think these bookends perhaps do help some of those newer fans, especially because of the ones that they've picked. You know, they've obviously got Ace and the Seventh Doctor again. They've got, his name escapes me, from Sarah Jane Adventures with Joe Grant.
Clyde,
thank you. They've got Peter Davison and Janet Fielding again for Earthshock, where they could have gone for Sarah Sutton in theory, or even Matthew Waterhouse. That would have been fascinating. So I think these are sort of kind of like, these are pairings which, and a lot of them, which audiences will be familiar with.
Yeah.
New audiences. So again, I think it's a bit of a bridgeway to get them to watch old material. And I think that's great because, I mean, I've been watching, I must admit, I've been quite indulgent the last few days, disgustingly so.
Have you?
I
don't think we need to hear about that.
Well, yeah, I think you do need to hear all about this. It's filthy. I watched what was the one for Tom Baker? I watched Creature from the Pit because I realised I'd never watched it all the way through.
Right.
So I thought, well, I'll watch it all the way through.
Yeah.
And then realised I had lost nothing by not watching all the way through. you know. And then I thought, okay, that was interesting. Leisure Hive. Not watched the Leisure Hive in a long time.
Leisure Hive.
I really do. I rewatched it and I really enjoyed the Leisure Hive. Fascinating to see, you know, that was a period where, again, obviously, because, well, not obviously, but Buck Rogers was on ITV at the time. Yeah. You know, had a massive impact on the ratings for Doctor Who. And maybe also, as I'm sure Gareth Gavanna would argue, the more sort of science-focused, less humour-based vision of that era may have also impacted on it.
The thing about that is probably, as well, I don't know if you're the same for this, that is the first series of Doctor Who I remember being mentally coherent enough to remember.
Yeah.
I'd remember things from earlier, having watched DVDs and stuff. I watched them on UK Gold, various bits and bobs from before that. But that is the series. I remember when that started with a new theme tune. I remember the theme tune was different. I remember watching the Leisure Hive and those Stranger for Marzi and David Haig as Pangol in there. I was actually watching him the other night in Midsummer Murders.
Yeah, he gets around.
He does, doesn't he?
But it's funny, I mean, I know we've talked about this before, but my first memory of Blake Seven is 1980 with Aftermath, which was the first episode of season 3.
Yeah.
And my first memory of Doctor Who that I can legitimately remember are the Famazi. It's a scrambled memory. I seem to remember them sort of coming out of something, but I think it might have been the revealing of one at the end, or what the one is, end of part 3 or whatever it is when they reveal the Famazi.
Yeah.
But I those are my first memories, but my parents always told me that I was watching Blake Seven prior to Aftermath when Gareth Thomas was in it. So I'm assuming it was the same for Doctor Who. And I remember getting the State of Decay audio tape and obviously knowing what Doctor Who was all about. So it's weird how that kind of was a period where my memory clicked in for the show.
I've also got the State of Decay audio tape.
Yeah. Yeah. Read by Tom Baker.
Mm.
That man. So yeah, I watched that. And more the last day or so, over Saturday and today, I've been going through from the moon base, and I'm now onto the Eve of the Daleks. I've done the moon base, Macra Terra, the faceless ones, and I'm now on, because I'd not watched any of those in their animated formats, so that's been really interesting as well.
Yeah,
and the animation is pretty reasonable. I mean, I loved the moon base was very nicely done, but I still kind of like they do the police box very well in the Faceless Ones, Macra Terra, and Evil of the Daleks. That means a lot to me. I did try starting to watch Galaxy 5 and Galaxy 4. Galaxy 5, brain's going. Galaxy 4.
Yeah, it's Galaxy 4. I've seen Web of Three Apart 3 likened to a PlayStation cutscene.
Which one's that, sorry?
Web of Three of Three.
I've not got to that yet. So I'm slowly making my way through bits and bobs. And it's been kind of interesting. I've really, really quite enjoyed watching these animated episodes, maybe where I've not actually had to, I just couldn't bring myself to directly buy the DVDs, having not really massively enjoyed the animated ones previous.
No.
Respect them, but just not my thing.
Yeah.
But I've really quite enjoyed this run. I think also because it feels like there's a very deliberate attempt, especially with Macra, to actually give it a feeling of scale, which they obviously, the original series, failed at with their one Macra, oversized Macra prop. Mm.
Yes.
And here you're able to actually really make them and make the colony feel like a colony on a planet. So it's been really interesting to watch. So yeah, I mean, I've been enjoying this. This November's been great for me so far. It's been, yeah, it's actually got me back into watching it.
You don't have to watch classic episodes of Doctor Who in November. I mean, you don't have to do anything. You know, you can just like wait around and wait for the new episodes. I mean, you might not want to do that either. But then again, I'd beg to know why you're listening to this podcast. But yeah, not the matter entirely. But you can
probably listen, because Doctor Who's like 30% of it, and the rest of it is about other things.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. You can listen as well. BBC Sounds is now the host as of the 1st of November. There's a Doctor Who on BBC Sounds. Missing episode soundtracks.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So BBC Sounds press release says, sadly, not all of Doctor Who's earliest years survive in the BBC archive. Many episodes have been lost, seemingly forever. But thanks to the ingenuity of fans, or even ingenuity of fans, sound recordings of these missing episodes survived and were returned to the BBC. Combined with narration from the stars of Doctor Who, here's a chance to listen to three adventures starring the first two Doctors. It's not entirely clear what it is based on this, but we suspect it might be the Celestial Toymaker, Power of the Daleks. There's probably a link I can press here to sound less stupid. Although if it was that simple, my wife would have done it years ago. We'll obviously cut this bit out.
Must we?
Probably.
I mean, like, by saying so, you're suggesting there's a baseline equality here that this does not mean.
Yeah, you see, okay, sure, so in fairness, I can't find what it might be at this moment in time. But I suggest you all just head on to BBC Sounds and whatever is clearly from the 1960s and is in the soundtrack only format is clearly what I've just told you about.
I'm not seeing anything. I'm just seeing Radio 2 celebrating.
Yeah, I'm not seeing anything at the moment. Yeah, same here.
Oh, what's this? Specifically recorded audio. Oh, no, that's their...
Well, there's the linking stuff. But I think what we're getting here is got to be, isn't it? Isn't it got to be the CD audio releases from 20 years ago, now hosted on BBC Sounds? That's what it seems to be to me.
That would be the guess, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Although apparently not there at this moment in time. It's probably a good idea, actually, whilst we're talking sounds, to talk about a couple of things. Number one, the theme tune. And number two, that nice chat between Davies, Chibnall and Moffat that's been shared on YouTube. Now, you gave me the link to the new rendition, the orchestral rendition of the new theme tune a few weeks ago. I have to say, I'm not a fan.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I can kind of understand that. I'm not a massive fan of it, to be honest. I don't dislike it, but it doesn't, in its current state, doesn't do anything fresh for me.
No. I was very big a fan of Sega Nakanola's. I wasn't initially with it. It's kind of what I was expecting, something new and different and very electronic. But as the series progressed, it clearly was the... God, I was really close to saying it was like the one consistent benchmark of quality across Chibnall's era then, which is a really unfair thing to say. But perhaps at the time that is really what I was feeling. But it just felt right and a good departure from what we'd had before from Murray Gold and his successor, whose name currently escapes me.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I really quite liked the sort of Murray Golds, he opens them, okay, you know, with a slightly different chord progression. Both for this sort of 2005 era and the 2010 era as well.
Yeah.
And this new progression, doesn't really do anything for me. It doesn't sort of build.
It feels to me, and I'm sure this isn't the case at all, but I feel as though it wants to be the TV movie intro, but can't be because that's already been done. The TV movie tune and how that starts, but he can't do that because that's already been done. So he's looked around for another way of doing it. Yeah, I'm hoping it sounds a lot better, you know, through the TV speakers in, you know, the studio recording with all the necessary treatments and compression and boosting and whatever takes place in the studio.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, it's a difficult theme, isn't it, to do, I mean, we've talked about this before many times, to do in a way which gives it energy and yet is close enough to the original.
Yeah, you're right. You can't do it on the harmonica particularly easily, so.
No, you can't. You as in one can't, yes, and you as in Christian Corley can't. It can't be done on the harmonica. But I think the harmonica is a point, is that it's the theme tune, as soon as it's played using conventional instruments, has a tendency to kind of lose its sound.
Well, you know what it needs. You know what it needs, and it brings us back to my other favourite show again. It needs a theremin.
But that's why, I know we've talked about this before, why I always think Peter Howell's one is so incredible, is the way that it suddenly we move into an electronic era. And it's clearly electronic, and you can hear guitar, electronic synths in there, and yet somehow it doesn't still sound like an 80s electronic theme. It still manages to carry somehow some of its own uniqueness to the original Derbyshire render of it.
Well, do you know, you've brought this up, and I just have to listen to the Peter Howell version right now. So
is that while we all sit in silence while you do? Just checking.
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
that's okay. That's fine. Yeah. Because I was half tempted to listen to the new one in the same sort of way. But yeah, I mean, the Peter Howell one, I still think, regardless of it being whether it's your ear or not, yeah, I can just about hear it in the background there.
Yeah.
To me, is a really clever mix of that electronic age, and yet somehow it still carries some of that sort of Doctor Who flavour without actually having to pull from it like so many other versions end up having to do, that somewhere in there is kind of that Derbyshire bit in the background to give it that sort of organic and enigma, I guess, to it.
Yeah.
So it is a really difficult one to do. And I certainly think the it's the only one in the 80s which does work. I think the remix for Colin Baker's Trial of the Time Lord series and the McCoy one as well just don't work. They're not terrible. They just don't work. They feel like something you'd find on a sort of 1980s space sci-fi soundtracks of the 1980s cassette. The sort of Jeff Love thing that you'd get at the time.
Let's just do that again. This is the what we were discussing. I just want it to be less like Last Night at the Proms, I guess.
Well, that's how it feels, because it is all done. It's the dominant force in it is the orchestra, and I think it's a sound which just doesn't work with an orchestra particularly well. And I kind of found that a bit with McGann's. McGann's was quite an interesting take on it, especially the use of the piano in there, which was very 90s, sort of post Bowie, Trent Reznor, kind of dropping these sort of very sort of dry piano bits in. But
doing slightly off the wall arpeggios as well.
Yeah. It just really is of the era. But by and large, I just don't think they work. And I was re-listening, sadly, I must admit, this was really sadly, to one of those, I think it was actually BBC's own run of the changes in the Doctor Who theme tune throughout from 63 to 23, as you get many of them on YouTube, but this was BBC's own one. And it was interesting just listening to them go, and I was listening to the original Murray Gold one, and there's just bits in it. There's a bit halfway through where TARDIS suddenly changes direction, where the bass line, that original bass line is really clear, and it's very unusual rhythm plays it. Just for that moment, you really hear it. and you lose that sort of stuff. I think you lose a lot of that sort of strong sort of bass push in orchestra stuff sometimes. But at the same time, I think you need anything more than orchestra, which is why I think Howell's work. But I do think Howell is unusual, because I've never heard anything other than, I can't think of anything other than Murray Gold's original and Peter Howell's, which really done the Derbyshire version a good going. I mean, the Smith version was all right. I didn't mind it. I kind of like, as I say, the opening chord progression. I hated the Capaldi one with a passion. Even though that, again, did sound a little more unique. It was just, to me, it was painful in my ears. But yeah, no, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how they do it and how it links with the, you know, the feel of the intro, you know, the whole visuals and everything else. But it does feel like we've headed back in time to the sort of Davis era. You're feeling the fingerprints of Davis very much in this.
Oh, yeah, and Phil Collinson, because he's back as well.
Yeah, well, all back, aren't they? But the whole notion, just, I mean, the whole the Tales of the TARDIS is very much, I mean, I could also, to be fair, I could see Moffat doing something like it in terms of the stylisticness of the writing. But the whole notion of bookending these old shows with this feels so much like a sort of, that sort of Russell T. Davis extra material sort of thing that he was doing back in the day with webisodes and the likes.
Yeah,
got that same sort of rationale behind it, that sort of extending everything outwards in a way that's kind of meaningful, which we lost a lot of, I think, as the years went on. So it'll be interesting to see where it all goes and whether we'll see, you know, a proper Hooniverse shift, whether there will be other shows or other mediums that will start making Doctor Who something which is far less about that singular show on television, but about other parts of that universe.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably worth mentioning that the whole BBC iPlayer Hooniverse thing has got the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Has it got, I'm thinking it's got K-9 and Company in there as well.
It's got most of the stuff.
It's got the Dreamland. It's got Doctor Who Confidential. Yeah, K-9 and Company, Girl's Best Friend, that's also in there. Remember, if you have never seen K-9 and Company before, the opening titles, and you don't know what it's about, the opening titles, you could be forgiven for thinking it's about a woman who turns into a robot dog. Now, there are, of course, plenty of other things that we could be talking about in this podcast, and we will no doubt get to them in a few weeks' time. A quick bit of information for you, presuming you are a subscriber and listen to the show regularly, and if you're not, if this is your first time, then firstly, where the hell have you been, and secondly, why? We have a new Star Trek podcast, continuing the previous discussion that James commenced with John Kenneth Muir a few weeks ago. That'll be coming up in a few days' time after this one. Later this month, we are, and into December, we're going to be discussing, reviewing, opining, whinging, whatever, about the Star Beast, and then Wild Blue Yonder, and then the Giggle. And for that, I'm hoping to be joining us will at least be Philip Bates of the Doctor Who Companion and a gentleman who may be well known to long-running listeners called Brian Terranova. Those two, at least, have almost agreed. So fingers crossed that we can sort that out and arrange the times and make everything sync nicely for that. Thank you for listening this week. And, you know, as ever, bash us an email. I mean, you don't very often, particularly. They usually come through Twitter or Facebook. But, you know, emails to editor@casterbris.co.uk or podcasterbris@gmail.com. They will find their way to me. And if they're particularly interesting, they'll also find their way to James as well. And I should finish off by saying that I'm attempting to gather enough subscribers to issue a regular email about classic Doctor Who and classic TV series and classic TV in general, because, you know, it's a big thing that they're being watched. All TV shows are being watched by more people than they've ever have been before, thanks to ITVX, UK TV Play and various other streaming services. So I think it's a very good topic to get a regular update on, in my opinion. Possibly yours as well. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, James, and we'll be back next time. Until then, it's goodbye.